Well, this is KHENLPFM Radio, Salida, Colorado, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And I have Professor Eric Carlstrom as my co-host this evening, and our guest tonight is Chris Horner. And Eric, would you like to introduce Chris?
Yeah, I would very much. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Chris. I actually have to tell you that I teach a class in human ecology as well as several in physical geography at Cal State University Stanislaus in California. And we're using your book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism, in my human ecology class. So I've been reading that book as well as my class, and I've also got your other book called Red Hot Lies, How Global Warming Alarmists Use Threats, Fraud, and Deception to Keep You Misinformed. And these are very recent books. Red Hot Lies is 2008, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism is 2007. And so you've been very active and outspoken in this. You've been on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. You've been on Glenn Beck's TV show. You've been interviewed by lots of people. And it's just a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Eric. My pleasure.
I guess you just got off of another interview, and so it's great that you take a little time. Now, you work with the introduce this by reading what's on the back of your book here, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism. It's a quote by Dr. Richard S. Lindzen, who's a MIT professor of atmospheric sciences. He says, future generations will wonder in bemused amazement that the early 21st century's developed world went into a hysterical panic over a globally averaged temperature increase of a few tenths of a degree, and on the basis of gross exaggeration of highly uncertain computer projections combined into implausible chains of inference, proceeded to contemplate a rollback of the industrial age. Chris Horner takes us through this story, including fascinating investigations into the role of major industries and the muzzling of science, with verve, humor, and a genuine concern for accuracy. His descriptions will provoke laughter as well as recognition that tears are more in order. So, Chris, this is Christopher Horner. He's an author now, is now working with the Competitiveness Enterprise Institute, I believe. Is that correct, back in Washington, D.C.?
All right, Competitive Enterprise Institute.
What's that?
Yes, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Yeah, and could you maybe tell us how you got involved in this issue? I know you told a story to Glenn Beck about how you got involved as a lawyer for Enron at the table of Kyoto Protocol debates.
Yeah, it was my firm. I gave some advice on unrelated issues to Enron while I was practicing, but my firm represented Enron in other areas, and they came to me one day and asked me to be director of federal government relations. This was in the spring, almost exactly 12 years ago, of 1997, before there was a Kyoto Protocol. And it was essentially no interview job offer. I said, sure. It was first or second day. I walked into a meeting with a green pressure group in Enron's suite of offices just across the street from the White House called Natural Resources Defense Council. And, okay, that's fine. And the next day, I was, again, fairly naive. I'd been just practicing law for the most part, didn't quite understand a lot of the ways that Washington works, I suppose, and the history of something called rent-seeking, where companies seek to make their fortune off of governmental policy favors as opposed to competition and innovation. So I didn't understand Baptist and bootlegger coalitions, which is essentially two otherwise opposed groups getting together to advance a common agenda. So that's what Enron and Natural Resources Defense Council were doing. And the next day, I sat in for Ken Lay at a meeting of something called the Business Council for Sustainable. They've changed their name several times, but I think it's energy or environment. And on my left was the Union of Concerned Scientists, and my right was the American Gas Association, BP, Niagara Mohawk Power, and others. And I asked one of those companies' representatives, and this was all at a very high level. Again, I was sitting in for Kenny Boy, and this was essentially general counsel level. And what were we doing sitting around a table with people who wanted to put us out of business? And he laughed and said, well, they want to put coal out of business first, which is fine if you want to do it on the merits, but they were working together on this "do what I want or everyone dies" theory to get a treaty. That was my point, and I mean, apparently that was my number one priority, which I hadn't been told. So I sent an email, "Houston, we've got a problem." They didn't like that. Strange and even bad things started happening in the office, and I left. And I've been working on the other side for the most part ever since. I was not a lawyer with Enron, so I can tell you about these things, but I am a lawyer now working against the Enron agenda, which is largely pushed by companies that picked at the carcass of Enron and took their assets and therefore their business plan, like GE, BP, which has their solar panel company. Enron had the world's largest wind company, and that was GE now, and big natural gas pipeline, which is broken up among many owners, Warren Buffett, GE, I think Kinder Morgan has some, but a lot of companies who have assets that would make them rich if they could get a carbon rationing scheme in place. And that was my introduction to the issue, and that explains to a lot of people who might be confused by this argument that's made that, well, how bad an idea can it be? Some of America's most successful companies are also pushing it too.
Okay, so the story we get is that your introduction to this whole issue was a deep education in how corporations are in cooperation with various environmental groups like National Resource Defense Council, et cetera, and the U.S. government representatives. And the idea behind these kinds of meetings is for Enron and other companies of like ilk to profit from government policies such as carbon rationing. And how would they profit from carbon rationing?
It's varied, and I can give you several examples. Wind is obvious. Wind is a niche operator. You want to operate off the grid, that's fine, but as far as providing society with anything, well, for baseload power, the stuff we need to get by during the day, it's just not going to happen. But they can try to force their way in through mandates and what are called renewable portfolio standards and subsidies, of course, which whether or not they ultimately supplant any hydrocarbon energy is beyond the point. If you guarantee, as they do in Europe, for example, 575% return over the rate paid by ratepayers for other energy to investors, you can create syndicates whereby it's essentially a Madoff scam, if you ask me. Ponzi translated means renewable subsidy in Spanish, I'm convinced, because I just heard a report from a Spanish professor of economics who said that they guaranteed a 575% return for 20 years, and then it's down to maybe 450 for the next five. It truly is a racket, and good work if you can get it, if that's how you choose to, where you choose to cast your lot. It's different by the company or the industry. Solar has the same interest. What about the coal-fired interests? For example, there's a Kenley protege named James Rogers. He's now CEO of something called Duke Energy. He was, for a while, CEO of a utility called Synergy, which merged with Duke, and it had a very old fleet of coal-fired power plants, and they were the paradox. Why is Synergy lobbying for a regime that is designed to put coal out of business, according to our president, when he was a candidate, being interviewed by the San Francisco Chronicle's editorial board? It's designed to bankrupt coal. Why would they be pushing this? Well, he's very clever. He learned at the right hand of Kenley, and he learned that he could get paid massive amounts of money through increased rates or selling ration coupons that the state would give him if he got this, if the right scheme that he designed were in place. That is, if he switched he has to fuel switch at some point, and if he switches to gas, and he can get the gas, which is a problem, he would have all these ration coupons that he otherwise would have to essentially burn down by producing electricity through coal, and he would have them to sell to other people. It would be an enormous windfall, which is not, as we're taught to believe, a windfall profit is not a profit made by an oil company. It's a profit thrown in their lab because of a gratuitous governmental policy to a favored industry. A nuclear power company, some of them, like Xcel Energy, are the biggest lobbyists for this. Great, nuclear, make your case on the merits. However, do what I want or everybody dies isn't very convincing. And what they're doing is they want a different kind of scheme, similar but not the same, whereby nuclear producers are given ration coupons on the basis of what if we produce this amount of electricity but by burning coal? And then you've got other interests, and then Wall Street's pushing it because Enron set up a trading floor with Goldman Sachs to play bookies, wetting their beak at both ends, selling ration coupons. and so on. I mean, it's you look at this enormous pile and you think there must be a podium there somewhere, but there really isn't. This is essentially made up, I'm sorry, by a bunch of folks who have perpetuated it more successfully than the grain industry could have alone. Because the corporate constituency is very attractive to politicians, I'm sorry to say, cynically, and there are different angles. I'll close by saying this. The beauty of it is, you all living out where you do know this. If you watch any old Western, when it comes time to split up the loot, the thieves always fall out. And that's where we are, because everybody's got it's got to be designed a certain way for Duke to make money, a certain way for the Nukes to make money, a certain way for GE and so on. So they're falling out splitting up the loot right now, which is what's holding it up, fortunately.
Okay.
So it's kind of a sting, then, in a sense. I mean, like they could be stinging each other in a way. Am I following you correctly?
At bare minimum, they're spending an awful lot of money. Remember, you hear about ExxonMobil. Oh, they gave whatever it was, a couple tens of millions over the course of a decade to various groups, part of whose portfolio included advocating against energy rationing. Well, Al Gore just got $300 million from someone. He doesn't have to tell us who, because he operates under 501c4 of the tax code, which says he doesn't have to tell us. $300 million is, pardon me, a lot of money, far more than anybody's ever gotten collectively in total since the beginning of time on the other side of the issue. Somebody sees this as an enormous investment. And if they lose, well, somebody's wasted. According to my calculations, and I'm only quoting the Greens, they think they spend about $210 million a year anyway pushing for this. So the sting at bare minimum would be they threw a lot of money down the rat hole trying to scare people.
Well, okay. maybe he was in there to get some of that bailout.
You know what? I wrote something in Human Events as well as Energy Tribune pointing out that there is a commonality. The companies pushing this most aggressively do have a history of being prosecuted for market manipulation. However, and I name the companies, there are also an awful lot of companies, those who fared the worst had an awfully huge stake in this idea of setting up a green trading floor, selling green credits and essentially green derivatives. Lehman Brothers they managed Al Gore's company, Generation Investment Management, money. Teddy Roosevelt IV, I believe, was the guy pushing them into this business. Bank of America, four of the leading bank collapses are four of the most aggressive cheerleaders for this. In Europe, they called it our new playground, the brokers. They're trying to create a market where none exists through creating artificial scarcity, through government fiat, so that they can make money selling nothing.
We in California experienced one of Enron's dirty dealings, of course, back in the 2001 time, just before Enron went under, when they created an artificial gas shortage here, and our energy bills went up, 50%, 100%, 200%, and this state, which had a $10 billion surplus prior to that, quickly got a $10 billion deficit. And so we should understand that manipulating the energy market can be very, very expensive and bad for us.
Let me tell you something else. It's also habitual. It's a tough habit to break. And I say this because you're onto something. I'm serious. If you look at...
Oh, I know.
I left Enron, and I was the crazy guy standing on the street corner in a pinwheel cap and a surgical mask, muttering about this evil company that everybody in town loved. Republican, Democrat, Clinton, Bush administrations all loved them. And then the unpleasantness came. And then suddenly everybody wanted to talk to me. And in the Washington Post piece that ran, I think, on Christmas Day of 01, the reporter came, sat down. I told him about this company it was what they did. They were always scheming on how to make money off of nothing. And you've all gone to school. We've gone to school with these people. We've seen them. And he looked at me, tapped the pencil thoughtfully against his forehead and said, so what you're saying is maybe they weren't that bad after all? Because they were pushing global warming. I said, no, you aren't listening. This is what they do. This is a red flag. You should have seen this coming. And you look for this common among companies, which, by the way, happen to have a few things in common. People who are trying to make a fortune off of doing nothing and are willing to pay groups to scare you into this while they wait at the bottom of the slide with this enormous web, to sort of paraphrase a Far Side cartoon, might be crazy if we pull this off, we'll eat like kings. Well, that says something about the company. It was true in Enron's case. That wasn't just a lucky shot. You look at Lehman, you look at BOA, you look at Calpine and their market manipulation. You've got companies who are attracted to this for a reason, and that reason is that it appeals to them, this idea of making money off of nothing, and that should be a red flag.
Okay, so this whole then public relations scare campaign on catastrophic man-made global warming, you would argue that this is basically nonsense and that it has a underlying business agenda. Would you say that?
I would say, people always say, what's the motivation? And there's not a universal motivation. Population zealots love it because it ultimately would coerce, if not force, population reduction significantly. Pro-state zealots love it for obvious reasons. Anti-development folks love it for the sort. This symphony of hysteria has many chairs, but ultimately there's a large crowd for whom it distills to money. And green groups have very lucrative consultancies where they essentially say, you know, nice place you got here. Should be a shame if an angry green mob showed up outside. And have I told you I'm selling services on how to teach you to green your business? And then when they tribute stop, mob shows up and they come back. This is, an awful lot of people are making an awful lot of money off of this scare, which has led to its exaggeration. I mean, it was a plausible theory. It did warm for 2 decades. Of course, that came after cooling for 3 decades, and then now apparent cooling for another, if you read the literature, projected another 3 decades. And then, boy, the warming will really set in. Look, there's an awful lot. There's a big corporate constituency that's pushing it for a reason. There are also, at some level, just true believers. There's an appreciable segment of the population who have to believe things like this. They just need it to be true. And there's an awful lot of people who woke up very confused on January 21st because this was all about George Bush to them. And now it really can't be.
Okay, so it's a coalition of interest groups, but in general there's kind of a rubric of, shall we say, radical environmentalist ideology. And I read a quote from you. Václav Klaus, president of the Czech Republic and new leader of the European Union, said, man-made global warming is a hoax that threatens our future and the future of our children. Environmentalism is the new communism, and climate change is a myth. Could you comment on whether you find that to be a logical, true statement or not?
Well, I mean, climate changes, that's what it does, always has, always will. But
I agree with you on that.
By saying that, that makes me a climate change denier. So that's the world we live in. I think what Klaus said has a lot of truth. But here's the thing. Klaus spoke to a group that I attended this past weekend, and in his dinner speech he said, look, I talked to, for example, French President Sarkozy, who told me, I don't take this seriously. Don't worry. But you got to understand, we get 80% of our electricity from nuclear power, and we are doing a bang of business on nuclear's revival in Europe, and it was headed for the grave. And French technology and engineering and construction firms are at the forefront, and they're now exporting it to several countries in Central Europe, and they're exporting electricity. They're doing great on this. Sarkozy knows where France's bread is buttered, so to speak, and he's going to ride this thing. And in fact, I just spent 2 days with a Scandinavian retired businessman who's delivered to me some fascinating documents going back into the early 1970s, where none other than some nuclear industry types with conservative politicians saw this as a chance. They saw that cooling run, you know, temperatures run in cycles. They expected the cooling that was underway to end and a warming to come, and they wanted to ride that wave. And the documents are pretty damning. Some of them I have to take his word for it because they're translated from Scandinavian languages. But this is an issue that, you know, it was a plausible theory that's suffering badly under the weight of observations, that also its history gives us an awful lot of ammunition to be very, very suspicious.
Yeah. Now, you say you were at you were hearing some talks recently. Was that by any chance the second international conference on climate change?
Yes, and I happened to, my pleasure was to, although I pulled up the wrong PowerPoint and cheated my audience, I winged it after that, and I talked about something I just recently wrote a paper about, and that is there is an effort underway to get the next global warming treaty, which we are to agree to this year, declared a treaty everywhere in the world except in one place, Washington, D.C. Because if we don't call it a treaty, there's something we don't need, two-thirds Senate ratification. We've done it before. We've dealt with trade pacts, for example. NAFTA was a treaty, quite obviously, that wasn't a treaty because we said it wasn't a treaty. And then you only need a majority of 50 plus 1 in both houses. And there are individuals who are calling for this from the Brookings Institution, and it turns out someone in the audience sent me a paper written by someone with the Center for American Progress named Todd Stern, who was recently appointed the climate envoy for the State Department, and he wrote a paper calling for this too, for bold unilateral action on the part of the U.S. executive to force us into something because we'll never get two-thirds Senate approval. That's a very long answer to your question, so I got a plug in there for my current hobby horse, which is to make sure this doesn't happen.
To make sure that what? That it doesn't happen? Yeah.
Right, yes, declaring what it is it's called an executive agreement, whereby Congress they vote in a majority vote to waive the requirement of two-thirds of the Senate to ratify a treaty.
Yeah.
It's called fast track. Remember fast track for NAFTA. It's the
yeah.
same thing. But this quite obviously isn't NAFTA, whatever your feelings about that were, a treaty among three countries agreeing to lower trade barriers. This is a treaty among 190 countries, all of whom are considered indispensable parties and must be at the table, yet only 35 of them are covered, industrial titans like Luxembourg, Iceland, Belgium, Slovenia, Slovakia, and us, but not China, India, Mexico, Brazil, South Korea, Indonesia, so on, all top 15 emitters, all of whom will gladly take our jobs.
Okay. Okay, so what I gather from the last answer then is that if we were to go ahead and ratify this executive agreement, that this would be, in effect, a way, well, I'm going to kind of just go the next step, which is this going to help contribute to the pouring of the first world industrialized countries and the catch up of the developed countries. Would you say that this would be the case if we were to put limits on our use of fossil fuels and they were not going to put on similar limits, that this would result in deindustrialization and poverty in the first world, and then the third world would be rapidly catching up. Would you suspect that to be the case?
Yes. Here's the several problems with that, of course, but that's the goal. This treaty was never about China, although you know, there is a movement afoot, and I write about this in Red Hot Lies, to allow China to sell carbon offsets to us derived from where their population would be if they didn't have their particular family planning policy and where it is now as a result of that family planning policy. That is, coerced abortion-derived carbon offsets sold to the United States so that we really didn't have to reduce emissions. In case you needed any more flags along the way, that this is somewhere where we don't really want to go. But yes, you're talking about, for example, Carroll County, Kentucky. There's an American company called North American Stainless Steel, which is actually a Spanish company called Acerinox, and it's the world's second largest stainless steel manufacturer. They added 175 new jobs there 2 years ago because their then CEO said, I can't make these investments in Europe anymore. It's energy rationing. I have blackouts. You have green jobs mandates, which means I have to try to produce steel using windmills, and it's not going to happen. And so he sent 175 jobs to Carroll County, Kentucky, and more to South Africa. And he said none of them are going to Europe. And then we have a new steel plant being broken ground last year in Alabama by Tyson Krupp. Again, a huge facility. 32,000 construction jobs, 3,200 permanent steel manufacturing jobs, for export including. And none of that investment will come here if we do this to ourselves. I mean, we can assure ourselves of this because the reason it's coming here is because somebody else did it to themselves. And you don't have to locate in America. You can locate in Mexico. Cement in Europe has relocated to Morocco because it's a very CO2-intensive process, including when it sets. But they've decided to just make it in Morocco and sell it in Europe instead of doing both in Europe because of where these bureaucrats assign the CO2 emissions. This is a game at the international level. It is what Clausewitz would say about war. This is diplomacy carried out through the means of, it's essentially economic warfare, very soft, very genteel for the most part, except for the environmental groups, economic warfare being carried out by groups who, as I point out in Red Hot Lies, demand reparations, say that this is about leveling the playing field, who say that this is about making sure that they get rid. We've got enough. It's time for them to get theirs and to get it artificially. Because poor countries are poor not because of us. They're poor because of corruption, failure to respect property rights, intellectual property, and a failure to provide a transparent judiciary. In other words, no one wants to invest there. And this is a way to make people invest there. If you're going to build anything anywhere, it's going to be somewhere else. So this is a wealth transfer. It's designed that way, so it's hard to deny.
So they're using Agenda 21, essentially, to build up these third world countries with this environmentalist movement. Is that what you're saying here?
They are related. They're related. Mm-hmm. They're related to the something called the Global Compact out of the Secretary General's office as well. He had a career aide who spoke to a former colleague of mine who said, "This thing's scaring me. It's about putting an end to capitalism," which, of course, capitalism being principally the divider between the rich and the poor, those who execute it and those who do not. The kleptocracies and the thugocracies are going to remain poor, and this is a way to try to keep their... no Mandarin wants the Mandarinate to end, and so each of these countries is trying to find a way to keep what they've got, get rich but stay in power, essentially, without providing what's required to get rich, which would ultimately require them likely to leave office. And so what we're doing through this, what unfortunately many UN programs do, which is allow individuals who are keeping people down to continue keeping people down while getting rich in the process.
Right, right.
Okay, let's go back, Chris, if we could, to the role of the United Nations and the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in promoting these, I guess we'll just have to call it misperceptions and lies. Could you talk a little bit about the central role of the UN in this and the historic role?
Okay. The UN, the World Meteorological Organization, created this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, even though it's a UN body, as, you know, the WMO also has UN affiliation. And they created it. It was expressly chartered, I believe, in 88, in the 1980s. To expressly chartered to support a future climate change agreement. I think they called it global warming at the time, but to support a potential future treaty. And so you're not going to get both sides out of this group. And this group claims it's an intergovernmental panel, and it represents scientists from around the world who turn out, they're touted as world's leading climate scientists, which means anthropology teaching assistants, for example, true story, and transport policy instructors, instructors in the human invention of environmental change, and so on. But it's touted as world's leading climatologists and so on when there aren't 2,000 climatologists in the world. There are 80 PhD climatologists in America. And so they don't exist in Micronesia and Papua New Guinea where they don't have climate research budgets. But we have to derive a Noah's Ark of, quote, climate scientists to claim, look at our wonderful global project. So it's 2,500 participants. But it turns out they don't even write the document that's waved around as the product of 2,500. But both of you knew that because you could never write anything with 2,500 people. I mean, you've written something with a committee of 12, and it's a nightmare. So here's what happens. It turns out the one document that's waved around is proof, is on the first part. It's on the actual climate science. And it's written by 52 people. And I guess that's not impressive because they don't choose to sell it that way. They sell it as the product of 2,500, which is a lie. It's a flat-out, knowing, conscious lie. So they must think on its face it isn't that impressive. It's 52 people, waved around as the product of over 2,500. It is reviewed, but we now know for the first time that this document is not peer-reviewed in any sense of the term because the peer reviews were ignored. If they challenged it. Peer review, of course, means essentially you have to make the suggested change or explain why the change wasn't made. None of that's done. They simply ignored. And we know this because for the first time, thanks to a threat under the Freedom of Information Act, because the U.S. government's a party and they had the information, they released the comments of the reviewers and the responses to the comments for the first time in 2007 for this fourth assessment report. But just so we know how non-scientific this thing is, in the first assessment report, it showed 1,000 years of accumulated knowledge. It showed there was a medieval warming, there was a global cooling, then it warmed, though not nearly so warm as it was in the medieval warming, and that had been tapering off. It's a wonderful chart I use in every show I give. We know it's true because the UN told us. It's 1,000 years of accumulated knowledge. It's represented in artwork. It's represented in science from around the world about the global changes from Tasmania to coastal Peru to North America to Europe to Asia. There were global warmings, there were global coolings. Well, that's not going to work. So one UN lead author, Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona, sent an email to another scientist named David Deming at the University of Oklahoma. After Deming wrote an article that this guy indicated showed that Deming was an alarmist, which he was not. And he said, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period in his email. Well, the next UN report did get rid of the medieval warm period, and it made the Little Ice Age 30 years long, which is completely betrayed by artwork from around the world and agricultural records, official documents, and so on. They rewrote history because they had to. And this David Deming at Oklahoma, by the way, when he reported this, was fired. And he was fired at the behest of as I write in Red Hot Lies, of a donor who said, this is not what I intended when I gave the school all this money. He hired this group called, he engaged a group called FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. He was reinstated to the university in a different college, given an office that was not in the basement, and given his classes back. But that just shows you the pressures that are on academics to make sure you toe a particular line, as I'm sure you may have experienced.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk about that later. But okay, so you've outlined that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, came out of a 1988 meeting of the World Meteorological Association, which occurred in England, I believe, and that it has written 4 reports, and these reports have become which are given to the world. They're claimed to represent the work of 2,500 top world scientists, but in fact, it's a very small number of people whose work is actually represented in the summary for policymakers. And this then becomes the basis of lots of news stories. And what is becoming the most popular, the most important part of of their quote-unquote story is computer projections, computer models. And I think most people don't understand how that works. Could you tell us a little bit about how this then becomes kind of a substitute for science?
Right. The three of us and your listeners are living in a place called the real world. And computer modelers I don't know these things, and my children aren't old enough to teach me about them, but I understand there's something called Second Life figures or avatars, whereby you can create another life for yourself inside a computer game. That's where the global warming modelers live. And their Second Life avatars see a warming planet with polar bears dying. In the real world, it's not warming, and the polar bears are doing fine. However, I actually cite in Red Hot Lies scientists saying when, for example, they send out essentially submarines to measure the oceans, which they just know are warming, and they find out that the oceans aren't warming. In fact, they find out the oceans are cooling. And they say, well, there must be something wrong with the observations because my computer model says it's warming. That's, wow. At this point, you make no eye contact, back away slowly, and get the children behind you. Because these are people who should not be making any decisions for anybody. And yet they are saying things like, there must be something wrong with the observations. And this was not just one particular anecdote. There are several scientists saying, it has to be true, my model shows it's true. When in fact, as you know, a model it's a computer program where you guess at certain variables and interaction between them, and then you make certain assumptions. And one of the key assumptions is carbon dioxide, which is a trace gas to which man contributes at the margins, drives temperatures. And you give it a very strong forcing effect. You make a very sensitive climate to changes in carbon dioxide concentrations. And then you run a model and say, oh, my goodness, look, it all shows linear warming, except for the one that Al Gore uses, one scenario from one outlying model in his movie where he shows exponential warming. And it all shows it's somewhere between, you know, let's say 1.5 degrees and 10 degrees Celsius over a century. But observations show that's nonsense. No model shows no warming for the past 15 years. And that's a big, I mean, that's three decades is what they've arbitrarily arrived upon as reasonable for choosing a trend. But no model shows, they don't say it has to warm every year, year over year. But no model says it can stay the same for 15 years. That what we observe in storms, what we observe in the Antarctic, what we observe with sea level rise, what we observe with sea temperatures, none of those are projected by the models. The models are proven wrong. Now, they're certainly not fit for policymaking. I argue they couldn't, and I hope to find out, they could not be employed in court as science under this Dobert test, which says it has to be essentially, it has to meet criteria for sound science. These are very expensive playstations. They're very expensive guesses. They're proven wrong. The money we're now throwing at them further proves, we've got about 2 million more reasons this year to know they're wrong. And yet we're basing policy on them, and the IPCC treats them as gospel, when in fact observations show they're not credible.
Yeah, I think one of the really good videos, there's lots of good books and videos out now available that give the side of the story that you're talking about. And one video which is excellent is called The Great Global Warming Swindle. People can go and Google that and actually watch it on the computer. But one guy, in fact, the same guy, Richard Lindzen, makes the point that prior to 1990, the U.S. government National Science Foundation spent about $200 million a year on climate research. And that was based on natural climate changes for the most part. And then about 1990, under George Bush the Elder, this figure jumped to $2 billion. And now, from what I understand, the money comes more with strings to prove that humans are causing the climate change. And of course, if this then becomes the demand or the dictate, well, then he who pays the piper gets to call the tune. So the people who give the desired answer that indeed humans are causing warming manage to maintain their level of funding and do their computer work, and those who do not come to that conclusion are weeded out. So, and now I understand that the figure is more like $5 billion a year that this country spends towards climate science research, and yet most of that research is dedicated to proving that humans are causing a catastrophic climate change, which is hardly how science works. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I more than agree with it. I have to climb to the nearest rooftop and shout, we are about to make a very, very terrible mistake. In President Obama's first budget proposal, he assumes as a revenue source, because we don't have taxes anymore, we have revenue raisers. This happened in about 95, I think. The major revenue source is a tax called a cap-and-trade scheme, whereby the government sells these ration coupons. In Europe's scheme, they didn't have the political will, and they gave them all away. Here, we were planning on giving the most away with the promise that sometime when I'm out of office, we'll start selling them. And President Obama very boldly said, no, we're going to sell them all because I need that revenue for social engineering. And how do we know that's true? Because he's talking about a minimum of $80 billion per year. And you have to remember the largest tax in U.S. history, which was the tax to pay for World War II, which was an expiring tax unlike this, was $107 billion adjusted for inflation. So we're four-fifths of the way there already. But in a footnote, they reveal that they expect actually a lot more money. But what are they doing here, Eric? You touched on something very, very important. They are ensuring that there is only one answer. Because with any sin tax, as they call them, alcohol, gasoline, tobacco, or, we need the lottery, it pays for the schools, okay, that kind of thing, that which is demonized is suddenly a virtuous contributor to the public purse. It's now necessary for certain programs that the people want. It's different here.
Wow.
Look what they've done, though. They've not only made CO2 emissions necessary such that if he really did reduce it by 80% through his scheme, as he says, imagine how expensive the ration coupon would be to keep this revenue stream going, or where the tax is going to be raised to supplant this, what is, in all likelihood, given the footnote, the largest revenue measure in U.S. history. Okay, so we've not only made carbon dioxide emissions a necessary contributor, and they say they've been demonized, but you know what? We need them at some certain level because it's paying for our social engineering. You know what else they're paying for with this? Part of health care, nationalization, essentially. What they're calling green jobs, which is windmill mandates and things like this, $15 billion a year. This is to pay for all sorts of things. But what did they do in addition to making CO2 emissions necessary? We have now institutionalized as fact and as necessary the crisis of catastrophic man-made global warming. There is only one answer. It's paying for the budget. Who's going to get? Who's gonna, you pointed out the swindle where Nigel Calder had this great line in the movie. You know, if you want to get grant money to study the nut-gathering habits of the brown surrey squirrel, you throw in a line about the impact of climate change on the nut-gathering habits of the brown surrey squirrel, and you'll get your money.
Right.
And he's proven that. Well, now, you're not going to get your money if you want to look into, this is a crazy idea, I know, but that fiery ball in the sky, it tends to be warmer at noon than midnight for some strange reason. But the UN tells us we don't understand the sun. It's called low, they put it as low understanding, and so they don't count it. They don't even call water vapor a greenhouse gas, if you can believe it, which is the dominant greenhouse gas by far. So.
Yeah, so let's just talk about a couple of realities here. I feel like we're in a matrix of just colossal lies, and unfortunately...
Orwell.
The average American is hard-pressed to recognize the lies for what they are because they're repeated so often, which I guess was a technique that Hitler and Goebbels used. But we are told, I think, even by the Supreme Court now, that CO2 is a pollutant as a gas. And is that correct, Chris, that it is officially classified as a pollutant that the EPA can regulate?
I represented the skeptic scientists in this case. It did go before the Supreme Court in a friend of the court brief, and we were ignored, obviously. As Scalia pointed out in his dissent, that this was probably a predetermined conclusion by reading it. They wanted to say CO2 is a pollutant under the definition of the Clean Air Act, which was as follows. It's a compound released into the air. And the court said, well, that's all I need to know. And Scalia said in his typically piquant dissent, you just said that everything is regulatable by EPA from frisbees to flatulence because it's a compound emitted into the air, to which I said, don't give them any ideas. And, of course, you may have heard about the livestock flatulence tax EPA is considering, $175 a head and so on, because methane, you know, animals emit more than automobiles, and you can't, since nothing ever proposed would actually change the climate, you can't ignore agriculture. And trust me, with the vegans involved here, you're not going to. But the court didn't say it is a pollutant. They said EPA either regulated as a pollutant, that is, declared poses an endangerment to human health and welfare. And EPA, in their draft document leaked last week, actually is planning on claiming an endangerment to human health from carbon dioxide emissions, to which I respond, if you want to see a catastrophe in human health, take away carbon dioxide. it wealthier is healthier, and wealthier is cleaner, and it isn't us who trash the place, it's Mexico and India, because they don't have our wealth. So EPA's planning, well, here's what I hear from people who've been in with meetings with the principals in this administration. They don't want to let EPA loose on this because it triggers a necessary domino effect under the Clean Air Act, which was another way of saying this act was never intended to do this, as the court quite obviously knew. And it's going to be economically catastrophic, and they know that they're going to have to then rush to Congress and say, fix this. But the administration wants to threaten the Chamber of Commerce and a couple of business trade associations. You better come to the table. Nice place you got here. Be ashamed if this beast got out. And by the way, I'm unlocking their cage, was essentially the message. And if EPA were to be allowed to do this, which the administration does not want them to do, but they want the threat, yes, they would essentially bring the economy to their knees because, as you've learned out west with endangered species, when the court writes a law and leaves it so vague and says costs can't be considered, when Congress does that, the courts are going to say, I read the statute. Even if, as we've learned with courts, they will read statutes in the way they want to anyway. But when Congress abdicates its legislative authority by delegating to an agency, and the agency does what agencies do, and as the Supreme Court said in that Snailbarter case, hey, it says here at whatever cost necessary. So don't come to me crying about cost. Cry to Congress. You've got laws that are very poorly written and are being applied in ways they were never intended to be applied. And in this case that you're raising with CO2 as a pollutant, you're talking about massive economic dislocation, which will lead to people running to Congress to finally do their job. And this is one of these issues that just leads to, I think, very deserved contempt for our policymakers, because they will kick things down the road and reward constituencies, but just do the right thing. Well, that's sometimes a bridge too far.
Well, let me just say a couple words about the carbon cycle, because I do teach climatology and physical geography. And of course, we are carbon-based creatures. All life on this planet pretty much is carbon-based. If it were not for CO2 being in the primeval atmosphere, photosynthesis would not have occurred. The plant life would not have evolved. There would be no animal life. So CO2 is a essential constituent of photosynthesis. It's the basis of all plant life, and to even think that it might be regulatable as a pollutant is, of course, based on a tremendous misunderstanding. But let me just say what the reservoirs of carbon are, because there has been done some research on this now. We have about 360 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. As you say, it's a trace gas. Carbon also exists in larger reservoirs, however. There's 50 times more carbon dioxide in the ocean than there is in the atmosphere, and the ocean and the atmosphere exchanges CO2. And, of course, there's enormous amounts of carbon in the biosphere, that is to say plants and animals and soils. And there's even more carbon in the carbonate rocks, limestone and dolomite. And, of course, there are the fossil fuels, which are ancient carbon. And so the presumption in this whole debate is that humans are adding so much carbon dioxide by our activities of burning fossil fuels that we are making a catastrophic warming of the planet. The fact is that, as you said, water vapor and clouds contribute to, 90% of what we call the greenhouse effect, that the greenhouse effect is absolutely essential. Without the greenhouse effect in the atmosphere, the average temperature of the Earth would be like minus 18 degrees centigrade, in other words, frozen, and that humans are only contributing about 3% or less of all the carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide is not even the major greenhouse gas. So when you get down to it, humans are responsible for less than 1% of the total greenhouse effect, considering the other gases of methane and nitrous oxide and CFCs and most important, water vapor and clouds. And this whole thing then is but a tiny influence on the climate. As you say, the sun is much more important, as well as other things like clouds. So what we've done is we've taken people's basic lack of understanding of the carbon cycle, and we've managed to parlay this into some draconian fear tactic, which will allow some draconian societal changes and the transfer of wealth away from, the retransfer of wealth. The other thing I would just say is that 85% of our energy in this country comes from fossil fuels, and that when you burn these carbon-based fuels, carbon dioxide is added. And so we have gone from about 280 parts per million carbon dioxide in the pre-industrial age to the present 360. But that's small. And the plant people tell us that if you were to double CO2 again, or triple it, or quadruple it from its present 380 parts per million up to, say, 1,500, that agricultural productivity would increase by 20 to 50%, and that you don't get to the point where humans can be harmed until you get to 5,000 or 10,000 parts per million. So this whole thing is based on a complete lack of understanding of the world that we live in, what we call reality.
Right. A couple of things in response. First is this: we could get up to 5,000. What would it do? Well, who knows? But we know it's a logarithmic warming influence. That is, paint a window pane black and then paint it a second time. We're now on the third or fourth coat, where not much more that we add CO2 wise could do anything in terms of it being in terms of greenhouse forcing. But what the UK High Court found, that is, there's a diminishing window, and it's about closed. So if we wanted to pretend we're going to tinker with the weather like the Supreme Court thinks we can, you got to start about a century ago and avoid all the horrors of, industrialized man with the massive reduction in infant mortality and diseases and increased crop yields and all the other horrors to which we've been subjected, supposedly in return for a 1-degree warming. But what the court in the UK High Court found was that Mr. Gore's movie said something which is not found in the literature anywhere, and that's that CO2 drives temperatures. As far as I know, just reading the IPCC survey, there is no paper in the literature saying CO2 drives temperatures. All the papers say are like, well, if it warms 5 degrees Celsius, here's what will happen to the monarch butterfly. Oh, that's proof of global warming. No, it's not. It's a proof of somebody gaming out what would happen if it were 5 degrees warmer. And the court said, it turns out, that CO2 goes up after the warming because, as you noted, the oceans and the atmosphere exchange it. 400 to 1,600 years later, depending on which research you believe, the CO2 goes up after it warms. And then when it cools, and this is what defeats their theory, because they say, well, all right, CO2 doesn't start the ball rolling, but boy, it sure helps it along. Just watch how temperatures go up in Gore's movie. But then they go down again before the CO2 drops, which defeats this with positive feedback argument. And, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. It gets warm, it gets cold, it gets warm, it gets cold. And CO2 follows as opposed to leads. So CO2 doesn't drive warming. You can add more CO2 to the atmosphere. It doesn't change the relationship. CO2's warming potential from man, I suggest, is not detectable. But regardless, nothing ever proposed would do anything detectable. And that's what ultimately this distills to. Because we could talk about the science all day long. What about the policy? This is a political issue. It has been since it was hijacked. And it's a policy issue. Therefore, a lot of people are pushing it for a lot of their own reasons. And the problem is things like the Kyoto Treaty are sold as salvation. And then when you say, okay, well, what will the temperature be after this treaty? Oh, well, it wouldn't do anything. It's the first of 30 treaties, they say. Oh, well, why didn't you tell me that for 4% of GDP? Why didn't you tell me that? You're selling it as salvation, but nobody says that anything ever proposed would do anything detectable. They say 50 years of perfect implementation of Kyoto with no Europeans cheating, pause, wait for laughter, without China selling us indulgences, but actual emission reductions. Perfect 50 years of Kyoto, an undetectable 7/100 of a degree Celsius, according to Al Gore's advisor, Tom Wigley. In other words, nothing. All pain, no gain. And that's ultimately where we get down. You can claim the science is settled. I will accept every alarmist scenario you want to paint, and I say the more alarmist, the better, because it digs your grave, not mine, because I'm going to ask you a very embarrassing question. You're right. I'm wrong. What do you do about it? And that's when they stare at their sensible shoes and say, well, lifestyle, population, energy, well, pixie dust, whatever. Nobody says they can control the climate, but you have to put a down payment by adopting their lifestyle agenda, and that's where people should begin to get suspicious.
Okay, so what is being sold then as scientific consensus, and they use that word a lot, which of course is a political term, not a scientific one, and settled science then is in fact designed to bring us to certain policy objectives. So we're talking about the politicization of science. Now, there's a very good book for people who like page-turners, Michael Crichton's State of Fear, addresses these issues, and Crichton did a lot of research on this. And at the end, he's got an appendix saying why politicized science is dangerous. And he talks about two previous cases in which science itself was hijacked by policymakers in order to affect certain changes that they wanted to do anyway. And he's talking about the eugenics movement, which resulted in, you know, the killing of millions of people, and the Lysenkoism movement in the Soviet Union. And he's saying there is a precedent for science being hijacked for political purposes, for the science community to be corrupted and co-opted and forced into positions which have no scientific credibility, and that this had disastrous effects, at least for the people, the millions of people who were killed. So I would you say that's a pretty good comparison?
Yeah, and here's the problem. I think I make a pretty good case that, bleep me out if I'm stepping too far here, but science is donning the fishnets and working a corner here. Science has, I'll use the word, sold out. Science has sold out to this. I have been on TV shows with esteemed, they're actually bureaucrats, but they sell themselves as world-leading scientists, like William Schlesinger of Duke, at the time of Duke, debating Al Gore's movie and his alarmism. And on a TV show, national audience, he said it was masterful. He hit all the high points. Now, wait a second. He got cause and effect backward. And there's no literature that says anything other than that. He got cause and effect backward. And these esteemed academics are selling out, to use the kind word, for more than now $5 billion a year. You want to find out how settled it is, ask a climate scientist, can I spend the money productively elsewhere then? Oh, by settled, that's such an ugly word. I meant I don't like standing in line with everybody else with hat in hand for my annual appropriation and grants because, sort of finish where we started here, for better or worse, I think probably worse, the lifeblood of research science is the taxpayer. And it has gotten out of control that we spend more on climate-related research than we spend on AIDS, than we send to the National Cancer Institute. And science has said, sounds good to me. As Dick Lenzen mentioned, it makes their life easier. I suggest they are prostituting the institution of science, which therefore, when this falls, what does it mean? Well, it means we stop something terrible, but guess what? We have now damaged for decades the institution of science. That's going to be a problem. They are selfishly prostituting something that I suggest is not theirs to sell.
Yeah, and, you know, there are scientists who I think are credible and who have written about this. Dr. Roy Spencer has written a book called Climate Confusion, How Global Warming Hysteria Leads to Bad Science, Pandering Politicians, and Misguided Policies That Hurt the Poor, came out in 2008. And he says, I predict that the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, experience will end up being the worst case of scientific malpractice in history. Not that the scientists are at fault. I think they have been led around by some politically savvy, almost charismatic leaders. If the new president and Congress are not careful, the resulting, quote, subprime science meltdown we are headed for will have caused carbon dioxide regulations, which will make the current financial crisis seem puny by comparison. I agree with that.
However, I don't want to completely absolve individual scientists because I point out in the Establishment Attacks chapter of Red Hot Lies how individual scientists, in order to keep the gravy train coming unthreatened, have engaged in character assassination, attempts at professional, you know, assassination. They have been led around, and now many look around, otherwise good people saying, oh no, look where we are. But they are continuing the individual character and professional assassinations of people who threaten their gravy train. And I think that for that, at minimum, I can't absolve them. And I think ultimately, you know, we have institutions for which they can be held accountable if it gets that far. But I can't fully absolve them. I know what Roy's saying there, but it has been highly politicized. And it was from the beginning, you know, statements like the first head of the IPCC, unless we announce scary scenarios, no one will listen. In other words, we've got to try to scare people to get attention to make our agenda happen. No free society would ever do to itself what this agenda calls for. Of course they're going to lie. But individual scientists are helping it along, and I, you know, I name names, and I think that's necessary.
Yeah, the leadership of various organizations like the IGU, the International Geophysical Union, have come out with position statements on this in favor of catastrophic man-caused global warming. Now, it's very, very uncharacteristic of a scientific organization to endorse a theory. And yet you've got these mainstream organizations who have been corrupted into endorsing what I would consider, and certainly what you would consider, is completely a bogus scientific theory.
Yeah, now when you're speaking about these associations, you're absolutely right. These are institutions. They never pulled their membership. Not one of these groups. American Meteorological Society, AGU, posted a statement and got four comments. There's never been a survey. But you're right. These are institutions. I'm talking about individuals who have come in through the back door of the national academies, like Cicerone, the present head, John Holdren, now the president's chief science advisor. These are individuals who are fully complicit.
Okay, well, we see the problem, you know, from many aspects. Obviously, people like Al Gore and many, many other political people are scaring us to death with their rhetoric. I'll read just something from Al Gore. Humanity is sitting on a time bomb. If the vast majority of the world scientists are right, we have just 10 years to avert a major catastrophe that could send our entire planet's climate system into a tailspin of epidemic destruction involving extreme weather, floods, droughts, epidemics, and killer heat waves beyond anything we have ever experienced, a catastrophe of our own making. And then later in front of Congress, he says, I think we ought to have an immediate freeze on CO2 emissions, which, of course, would shut down our economy. Again, 85% of our energy comes from the burning of fossil fuels. And not only that, all human beings and other animals also emit carbon dioxide. So this is rhetoric of the highest order, and we see lots and lots of it to scare us into doing things, like you say, that we wouldn't do otherwise. But the question I have for you, Chris, is I've recently come to realize there are people that are working at other levels in society, so-called climate change agents. Do you have any knowledge about these kinds of programs?
No, I don't, at least not by that name. I've certainly encountered my share of activism, but not by that name, no.
Okay, well, I know that Al Gore has various disciples that go to seminars and learn to advance the cause this way and that way and the other. So there's probably, and of course this is a multi-billion dollar gravy train, so I'm just guessing that there would be many change agents that would work with environmental groups and others. You yourself say you were Greenpeace people went through your garbage, apparently.
Well, they were taking it every week. I'm not just, I affirmed it several ways. And I mean, it's not just, I didn't just pull the name Greenpeace out of the air. I confirmed this was Greenpeace taking my trash every Sunday night before the scheduled Monday morning pickup, and that of a White House aide as well, the guy smeared by Gore in his movie. The guy barely talked to me. And Gore, or Team Greenpeace, was just convinced that we were leading some conspiracy. And they were actually peddling my trash to newspapers in Washington who didn't bite. So they then successfully peddled it to Spanish news, El País in Madrid, the Guardian in Manchester, and the Independent out of London, who actually ran hit pieces on me for things that were unrelated, emails and things pulled out of my trash. But after I'd learned about this, for weeks I was covering, well, let's just say there was a local requirement that I pick up after my dogs. It was hot weather. I had a great time with this. And, I mean, these people will go, that's nothing. I write about in Red Hot Lies scientists who have the wheels fall off their cars, not once but twice when their children are in the cars because they speak out.
My goodness.
Death threats, professional threats, nasty, nasty people. Yeah, it's just, you know, enough. People say, why do you write the book? It's time to fight back.
Well, we sure appreciate you doing that. But this is the level of the rhetoric and the sentiment that we're dealing with. According to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., this is treason, and we need to start treating them, global warming opponents, as traitors. And then Ellen Goodman, the columnist, let's just say that global warming deniers are now on a par with Holocaust deniers. So there's a hate campaign against what I would call realists, global warming realists, or climate change realists, because as you say, climate's always changing. So there's this full-on indoctrination program combined to vilify and to try to tear down any opposition. And I suppose that you're experiencing this still. Is that correct?
Well, just various. There's always a film crew paid by. One time it was Soros, then it was someone else. Follow me around with a boom mic, but you know, just in case, not announcing their presence, just doing petty harassment. But remember, there's something in this. It's always personal. It's never substantive. And you have to, that is another red flag on the road. It's always personal. There was an article, I blogged about it on National Review maybe on Saturday, because I encountered it Saturday, where there's a conference call at 8:45 Eastern every day among these activist groups, including global warming groups, and they fully admitted to this reporter for a paper called The Politico that they get together and they say, anybody who opposes us, they all have pasts, they all have backgrounds, and immediately we'll tear them down. They're very open about this. It's always personal. It's never substantive. And why? Because argumentum ad hominem is designed to distract. The substance isn't with them. It was a plausible theory that's suffering badly under observations. So it's all about personal attacks and threats.
Yeah, pretty mean-spirited. Do you suspect that there's a relationship between, say, Obama's energy plan, which features these carbon tax credits, tax and trade schemes, and peak oil? Is there a relationship there?
I don't know. I think he might invoke it, but I think that this was a fairly reckless overreach of his on a policy level, and he's even unfortunately walking it back. I thought this would be his Waterloo very early in the game. I don't know how well thought out this is. It seemed to be a fairly knee-jerk, ideological reach for billions in revenue. And I think he will invoke everything he can. If his opening argument is, do what I want or everyone dies, I'm sure he'll invoke anything more plausible. Certainly the energy security, which I think is misapplied here. I mean, you can ask the polls if it makes more sense to keep the coal in the ground or rely on Russians for gas. This is not an energy security measure unless you're going to go full bore nuclear, and we're not. You go full bore windmills, and well, just wait for the invasion because that's not energy secure. The idea that we're running out, scarcity arguments will certainly be invoked. I don't know whether he'll use peak oil or not, but if his opening argument was it's because we're dangerously heating the planet even while it cools, of course he'll invoke peak oil.
Yeah. So basically his plan, as I understand it, is he wants to invest $150 billion over a decade in clean, climate-friendly energy. And of course, as you said earlier, wind and solar are niche technologies that can never, like you say, run a steel plant. They can never, they can't be relied upon 24/7 like coal-fired and gas-fired and nuclear plants can. And then he also wants to double domestic production of alternative energy over the next 3 years, dramatically improve energy efficiency, reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and reduce oil consumption by at least 35% or 10 million barrels of oil by 2030. Ensure 10% of electricity is generated from renewable energy sources within 4 years, 25% by 2025.
Never happened.
No, it can't. Greenhouse gas reductions by 80% by 2050 using a market-based cap-and-trade system, leading a new global warming partnership, reengaging the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, creating millions of jobs with new green energy economy. Is this just fantasy, or is he trying to deindustrialize us?
I don't know about that. I do believe he believes in redistribution and not just purely domestically. I believe he is not sure why, but an instinctive believer in global governance, which is what Jacques Chirac hailed Kyoto as the first component of. And he'll probably steer us toward that ship, starting with the Law of the Sea Treaty, which places two-thirds of the world's surface under common ownership. I have a feeling he's not, as a community organizer and memoirist, he hasn't spent much time thinking about these instruments of global governance. However, I think his instinct is to go for it, and he has surrounded himself with people who like the idea. So a lot of this is boilerplate dogma. I don't know how deeply he feels. He just believes. And it's so fantastic that, the starting proposition between those of us living here in the real world is never happen. So where's he going with it? Get what he can? Deindustrialize? I don't think so. Redistribute? Absolutely.
Okay, so but this idea that came out of Kyoto originally, the phase two, was to roll back our carbon emissions by 80% by 2050. And this has showed up in Gordon Brown's proposals in England, and it shows up here with Obama. As you say, this is impossible unless you want to reduce the wealth of these countries by a commensurate 80%.
There are three countries in the world that meet this, okay? Haiti, Sudan, and one other tragedy. And I don't remember what it is, but it's on a par. Okay? This is either hateful in the extreme or fantastic in extremis. Haiti, Sudan, and one other basket case meet these per capita requirements that he's talking about. You won't do it through pixie dust, okay? There is no pixie dust around the corner. If you were serious, you would say, well, then, okay, how about nuclear power as a bridge? Oh, no, millions will die from global warming, but your atoms, they frighten me. Okay, well, there's a moral tension there. You're not serious. You're just sort of anti-everything that flows from energy, right? Because everything that works is off the table. Everything that works is demonized. He's not going to 80%, but what sort of damage is he going to do in wherever it is he's trying to go? This is an agenda on which you don't negotiate. There are, we have this disease in Washington where everybody says, oh, you can't just say no, you got to have an alternative. I say, okay, let's just walk through history. The Jews have to go to camps. What's your plan? What's your alternative? How about no? I mean, do you say no to anything? And you're talking about killing millions here. We just need to teach people, say no when no is warranted. There is no negotiation on energy rationing. For Pete's sake, it's cooling. The models are wrong. The alarmists even project decades of cooling, but then, oh boy, just wait. At what point do we grow up and stop this nonsense? And hopefully, given the laundry list you just proposed, now is the answer.
Yeah, and especially if simple, decently informed people can point out that a doubling of CO2 would be good for plant and animal life and would have virtually no effect on the temperature, the alarmism, the scare tactics immediately lose their efficiency. They don't work anymore. I mean, the whole thing is based on a premise that can easily be proven wrong.
Right. If you accept their assumptions, man's done pretty much what he can do. Okay? So climate change is always has, always will. Man's always adapted. The wealthiest societies have always adapted best. That means the solution is not more Bangladesh, less Florida. More Florida, less Bangladesh, because the same storm's going to come. There are no trends. There's no indication they should increase in any way other than cyclically and then decrease again. You want institutions, automobility, infrastructure, emergency services, telecommunication. You want wealth to deal with something. And by the way, wealthier is not only healthier, it's cleaner. We are cleaner than Mexico just over the border. It's just a fact. Wealth does not, even the UN acknowledges that wealth is not what harms the environment. I mean, they say you need a certain per capita income that is now, I don't know, around $6,000 per capita. And before you start assigning a value to the environment, to some media, air, water, soil. And as you get richer and richer, you assign a higher value to it and begin paying for it and are willing to pay more and more to parts per thousand, to parts per million, to parts per billion as you get wealthier and while the economy is healthy. Right now we're wealthy but not healthy. And you need to, these are, put aside childish things, great, start with this.
It is a book by Jack Hollander, who's a professor at Berkeley, called The Real Environmental Crisis, Why Poverty, Not Affluence, is the Environment's Number One Energy. I think there is a real ideological difference between, say, the radical environmentalists now and people like yourself, who they would say that poverty is the answer. We've got to deindustrialize. We've got to put limits on people's wealth in order to save the environment, whereas you're using the counterarguments that, you know, all the data shows that richer countries are much better at keeping the environment clean than poor countries like, say, China, Soviet Union. Communist countries were by far the worst. So that's kind of an interesting ideological difference, and I think you've got the facts on your side.
Here's what it distills to, though, ultimately, and it takes about three questions, and you get there every time. I don't view people as pollution. They call people pollution. When I see a person, okay, I see a mind, a soul, a set of hands, they see a stomach. It's a completely different worldview.
Yeah, well, and I think it is somewhat alarming that the United Nations' own documents say that they believe that the Earth can only support about 1 billion people at the level of the industrialized world, in, say, the United States, maybe 2 to 3 billion at the level of Europe. So therefore, they actually have a vested interest in reducing the global population of humans. And this fits in with the idea, as you say, that people are pollution and we're the problem. Of course, that works fine for the global warming alarmism because they try to make us feel like we are the problem and we're guilty here. But the facts don't bear that out.
I quote them all over the place in my first book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism. And I have a chapter on how they really don't care for us. There's a very strong belief that there are just enough of them, way too many of you and me, having too many babies, taking up too much space, using too much stuff. And they don't show the type of bold leadership they call for by going first, of course, but they do want to massively depopulate the planet. And as I know, outside of disproportionately chain smoking and moving to Seattle, they really don't do their part to lessen the population.
No, they don't volunteer to start first. Here's a quote from the Club of Rome, which is a think tank that's written books like Limits to Growth, Goals for Mankind, Mankind at the Turning Point, and the First Global Revolution. They say, the Earth has a cancer, and the cancer is man. The real enemy, then, is man himself. The resultant ideal sustainable population is hence more than 500 million, but less than 1 billion. Of course, we have 6.7 billion. So what they're calling for is the reduction of the human population by 90% or 80%.
Right. And you know how they got there? They got there not through observations or calculations. They got there, I'm going to read you a quote from a 1991 book, The First Global Revolution, page 104. New enemies, therefore, have to be identified. That is, in order to rally the people around their agenda. Because, as I noted, no free society would ever do to themselves what this requires. Back to the book. New strategies imagined, new weapons devised. Ellipsis. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like, would fit the bill. In other words, this is the excuse around which to rally the population to accept their agenda. It is no, particularly now, no secret that crisis is the friend of, real or imagined, and real or exaggerated, is the friend of what used to probably call themselves totalitarians. It is invoked as a way to keep the people on your side. There's always a boogeyman, and it is always exaggerated. And they are saying right here in a fairly clear admission, in searching for the crisis is the enemy around which to unite the people. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, global warming would fit the bill. I get it. I get it. You made it up. And like this Scandinavian showed me, documents go back very far indicating that as the cooling was coming to an end, people guessed that it was, and they planned, they prepared to ride the warming to their hopes and dreams. That helped keep this thing going. Like I say, whenever anybody says, there's only one thing we can't afford in dealing with this issue, and that's debate, you know the thing doesn't withstand scrutiny, and that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, along those lines, Timothy Wirth, the president of the United Nations Foundation, said, we've got to ride this global warming issue. Even if the theory of global warming is wrong, we will be doing the right thing in terms of economic and environmental policy. So there's a number of statements that they themselves make that indicates that this is, in fact, a planned operation, really, on kind of a psychological operation against the rest of us to get to do, make us, like you say, do something that no civilized people would do to themselves.
At minimum, it's an excuse. At minimum, it's the latest excuse.
Yeah.
Can I just add to the fact that a number of these elites that are putting themselves at the pyramid to gain money from this? So, I mean, they're going to make money, you know, whether it goes one way or the other. But as long as they put themselves at the CO2E head of that, or these other corporations that are going to make money, I mean they're just, you know, they're keeping the money for themselves, and the rest of us, you know, are going to be giving it up to whatever that means they let us. Correct?
Well, self-interest is a very good thing. It's just that this is, you know, scaring people into, as I say, you know, do what I want or everyone dies, as a very dishonest way to separate a fool from their money. Is at the fool will believe it at his or her expense, but and risk. But it, when the state's involved here, as it is, I have to. You know, corporations are going to do what corporations do. I disagree with the notion that they have a corporate social responsibility to, quote, give back. They're not taking. They're creating wealth. However, they're going to do what they're going to do. The free market, like the Constitution, is not perfect. It's just better than what we have now, like the Constitution. The state being involved is where I really get upset because, you know, the state is, it has limited functions, but perpetuating such mythologies is certainly not among them.
Well, don't they kind of end up being the policing arm to feed the corporation?
That's what, yes, look, people throw around the word fascist without having any idea what it means. One of the corporatist state, of course, is more of the traditional definition where you're, you know, free enterprise is allowed to exist, but it must exist in the service of the state. This is in coordination with the state, which does alarm me. Remember, if it weren't for the corporate constituency, this issue would go nowhere. If it weren't for the corporate constituency and the issue were real, it would look nothing like we're dealing with it now. You would tax something you're trying to get less of. you wouldn't set up Soviet-style production quotas whereby you would reward favored industries in the name of, oh, I'm really going to stick it to them. Really? How come they're the ones lobbying for this? You would have something radically different. So I trust but verify with the corporations, but I'm getting less and less patient with the government, which is showing me less and less reason to trust them on this front.
Well, and I'm not against the corporations at all. I'm just it's that dishonesty there that is the part that's trying to bring it to the forefront.
Scorpion and frog. You know, it's what I do. It's not personal. But, again, with the state, to me, then I take it personally. Okay, these guys are going to lie to me because they want my money. The state's supposed to be, in my mind, in my construct, radically different. And, unfortunately, they're both – I have a chapter in Red Hot Lies, big government – abusing governmental power to expand governmental power. Therein lies my objection.
Right.
Yeah, and of course, to what extent is this a play then, you know, the common mantra is global problems require global solutions, and therefore the United Nations has to regulate this in a meaningful way across all the 190 countries, blah, blah, blah. And so in what sense is this indeed a play for United Nations control of the world?
Well, unfortunately, this mantra of global problems require global solutions has resulted only in more, quote, global problems. And and it's like, for example, as I point out in, I think, Red Hot Lies, if you want to cool the planet, reopen the Siberian temperature stations. Because when you shut those, we suddenly had the hottest decade, but not really. It wasn't a warming trend. It just shifted upward when you closed a bunch of Soviet weather stations. They had other things to worry about in 1990. If you want to reduce the threat of global warming, take away the goodies. And you're going to see the Duke Energies of the world, and they've already proven this. You take away their role, and you say, I'm sorry, taxing it's more efficient. At minimum, I'm not going to give you the ration coupons. Well, James Rogers ran around screaming about this greatest threat. We must act now. And by the way, you have to do it my way and pay me. And as soon as some individuals said, well, maybe we ought to just tax it, forget the middleman. Whoa, wait a minute, let's not be rash. Quick, look how rapidly we reduced the threat of global warming among one of its major proponents. Well, the same thing goes with the UN. Yeah, I know, it's a global solution and all that, but here's the thing, guys. You insist on a template that involves Micronesia, Papua New Guinea, and Burkina Faso sitting at the table with an equal say as me when there are only expressly, as we begin the negotiations, a few of us who are targeted, and the rest of the world is quite clear in saying a failure to grow economically is a much greater threat to me than the weather. Why don't we just have the countries who are impacted by your prescription sit around the table and talk? The UN suddenly has no interest in this whatsoever. You mean only include the 35 industrial titans like Slovenia, Slovakia, Luxembourg, Belgium, Iceland, who are covered by this, sit around the table? I have a paper coming out in a book. I wrote the chapter on international environmental agreements. It's coming out, the Heritage Foundation is publishing it. It's coming out this year. And I make this case that if you want to clean up this process, take away the opportunities for the UN to get any authority or attacks, which they're desperately trying through this issue. Take away the opportunity for the green groups to be certified as part of the process. Take away the free-riding countries who simply want a bag of money out of the thing, the wealth transfer. If you take away all the free riders out of the process, you would be amazed at how differently things turned out. But at bare minimum, I bet you would find a lot of the people shrieking about it, when, once there was nothing in it for them, would behave in a more realistic way, meaning they would prioritize risk a little differently, and this isn't among them. So I don't know if I said that clearly, but the UN having a stake in this is driving their alarmism, as is true with everyone else.
Okay, and you're writing this up as an article for what journal?
I wrote a chapter in a book on essentially global governance, on international treaties, and for the UN to open its new session, and the Heritage Foundation is publishing it, but now it's coming out from Roman and Littlefield. My chapter's on this idea of using multilateral environmental agreements to get their way.
Okay.
I don't know the name of the book, though. I'm sure I could find it quickly.
When you were mentioning those smaller countries, were they in the past colonies of Britain?
I'm sure at one point or another most of them were, but I don't know if that's their commonality.
Okay, well, I mean, because I'm just kind of going back to something that I'd heard Joan Vian speak of, is even though they are coming to the table with an equal vote, my understanding from her interpretation is that they actually vote in line with Britain. And so that would actually be increasing Britain's vote, which would override the other industrial countries.
Well, it turns out, among the at least among the Europeans, the British were the most honorable actors. And it's a long story, but they got to set their own rules and hand out their own number of ration coupons. And the UK, presuming everyone else, the French and so on, would behave like gentlemen, so to speak, in handing out their ration coupons and so on. And the rest of Europe wildly cheated. And so for 5 years, the EU, it's now public knowledge, the papers are, the UK public is the most skeptical of any, seeing this as just another excuse for a tax, because they saw how rampantly the Europeans cheated at this. Just handing out ration coupons to sell to the UK, whereby UK hospitals and schools had to buy ration coupons from oil companies. True story. OpenEurope.co.uk has a wonderful report. We republished it, Europe's Dirty Secret. UK hospitals and schools were buying their ration coupons from multinational oil companies who had gamed the system.
Mm. How long have they been selling those coupons, and are those what they're calling carbon credits?
Right. It kicked in 2005, and yes, it's essentially a carbon credit. It takes various forms. There's carbon offsets, where a bookkeeping scam, don't even go into it, and then there's the credits whereby the company has the country has a national quota, and then they allocate among their actors, and most over-allocated, and that did cause their market to collapse, and then it shot back up because governments, in coordination with their buddies in the industry, were gaming it. It's a classic tale of why you don't do this. It is so subject to gaming and so distorting that even when, thanks to mild winters, which have ended, and an economic slowdown, which has accelerated, during the 3 years that it was in operation, while economy-wide emissions dipped for mild winter and other reasons, emissions covered under the scheme that were promised to go down year over year actually went up year over year because governments cheat. This is about competitive advantage. Why does a treaty agreed in December 1997 that goes into effect in 2008 have a baseline year against which performance is measured of 1990? Why? It just makes sense, right? It's completely arbitrary except for one thing. After 1990, Europe experienced an economic collapse, and they are now calling that, quote, early action. I'm not making this up. They're calling their economic collapse early Kyoto action, and they therefore got credit for collapsing as if they reduced emissions through doing anything. And therefore, that's why it was targeted at us. And Al Gore fell for it. I mean, the unanimous Senate said, don't go agree to this treaty. And he flew over and he agreed to it. And although the media can't get his right, we signed it 11 months later. We never unsigned it. Bush should have unsigned it, but their profile and courage at the time was such that, well, the world will be really mean to us if we actually do what they already think we did. Don't try to ascribe rational thought to the irrational. This was mishandled from the get-go by both administrations. But we agreed to a sucker's deal. 1990 baseline, purely to accommodate Russian and Eastern Europe and Germany, which is their largest economy, etc., economic collapse, the UK, Margaret Thatcher went after the coal unions, shut down the pits, they dashed to gas, the gas is running out, but they had a massive emission decrease for one political reason. They made a decision to go after the coal unions and break them. East Germany shut down. Germany got credit for this, for a massive reduction in emissions, which was really just shutting down Soviet capacity. And so on. It's why Russia was bribed into this deal. All of Europe demanded one thing and one thing only, a 1990 baseline, because it was aimed at us. Three countries have to comply with this thing, U.S., Canada, and Japan. Australia's reduction was an increase. Spain's reduction, an increase. Ireland's reduction, an increase. Greece's reduction, an increase. Portugal's reduction, an increase, so on. This was a sucker deal to beat all sucker deals. But it's about posturing. And then nothing attracts the moth of Al Gore to a flame like this.
Go ahead, Melody.
Okay. Who's getting these carbon credits, and how, I mean, are NGOs even getting these things?
That's the ultimate question. They want them. What they do have is a paying role to certify emission reductions or transactions or credits. there's something in it for them, and that's why they're pushing this. This is a profit center. The idea is that, yes, they would be given credits. Ultimately, that was left to the individual member states, and so I'd have to say on a state-to-state level, I don't know.
Well, the only reason I'm asking that is I'd run across an IRS form done by the Nature Conservancy, and in there was something to the effect that GM had received some carbon credits, and I believe it was from the Nature Conservancy.
Oh, okay, that's a different deal. Nature Conservancy, you know, shakes down little old ladies into selling their land, and then they'll lock it up and then explore for oil on it. they're really, that's the racket beyond belief. And the Sacramento Bee a few years ago did a nice, they blew the lid off of Nature Conservancy. But what they do is they will sell offsets into our voluntary market, that's about posturing. Companies would like to say, we use 100% green energy. Well, they don't have any idea where the electrons coming in over the transom actually were generated. But they can buy, they can pay for the privilege of claiming that all the energy, the equivalent of their energy use, was green. And they can claim that by paying windmill companies or by buying offsets from the Nature Conservancy, which is essentially a promise, pay them to do with a certain parcel of land what they plan to do with it anyway, which is lock it up.
Well, one of the things I'd point out, too, is Hank Paulson was on the Board of Governors with them while, I believe, being CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Goldman has long been, they were working with Enron on this in the mid-90s, and I talked to the head of their energy practice simply because he was a close friend, who told me, oh, yeah, this is profit center, we're going to make a fortune off of this. You're essentially getting paid for doing nothing. And Wall Street's good at that, and that's why Goldman was pushing it. But Paulson personally was a uniquely aggressive actor, and personally as well, questionable ties with, you know, contributions of land related to organization his children were had an interest in, and so on, and it involved some lockups in South America and Nature Conservancy. And a colleague of mine's very up on the details. I have to admit I'm not, other than to say, there's a lot of smoke coming from Paulson's ceilings on this, but I can't detail the fire for you off the top of my head.
Okay.
Going back to a previous thread here, the UK proposed a carbon swipe card. Do you know where that's at?
Still being floated. Their government is not giving up, despite the fact that their public is, as I noted, the most skeptical among the Europeans. They are... I met with I can't remember if he was the energy minister for environment or environment minister for energy in the Polish government about a year and a half ago, who asked me, why are they so, they're worse than Brussels. He said, they come here making threats, offering deals, just, they're missionaries on this global warming kick. Can you explain why? And I asked members of the European Parliament who are UK Tories, I asked others, and they say, it comes down to certain individuals in the government, and they just don't know. But the UK is pushing things like, as you mentioned, an individual carbon swipe card, so that you are individually given an annual ration of, let's not dance around it here, energy use for the year. If you use less energy, you can sell it to someone else. It's exactly like World War II rationing.
Wow.
Okay. So if you use more energy, then you have to pay extra for it, I gather.
Right.
Or buy credit from somebody else.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it occurs to me... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, are they going to make that small... Are they achievable energy rations, or are they going to be, you know, something that we're always going to be in a deficit on?
Well, the idea is a linear drop of minus 80%. And it's to start where we are and go down from there steadily. So it's not like you get an annual ration. That you should get used to. You get one, and it's supposed to, you know, you could go down in 3-year tranches or 5 or whatever, probably less than 5. But it has to drop significantly, and they want to drop steadily so you don't notice it. So even while, you know, every time you shake a mouse or use a cell phone somewhere, somebody's burning coal or smashing atoms, ultimately you're supposed to do much, much, much less of that until the public takes to the streets and demands pixie dust to fuel our jets in the future, because that's the solution to make their ration cards work. I suggest avoiding it altogether is probably the better course.
Yeah, I've got a video called Nobody's Fuel in which a Canadian engineer who's worked with energy issues all his life is giving a kind of a basic accounting of how energy generation works. And he says there's a direct correlation between the energy that we use and our wealth and our lifestyle, and that if you reduce our energy use by 80%, well, you would have to commensurately reduce our wealth by 80%. There's just a direct correlation between energy use and wealth.
Barring massive breakthrough technology, sure. It changes by country because the French have made a social decision to rely on nuclear power for 80% of their juice. They could go further and rely on that for automobility if they were to agree to it, but barring major societal decisions or transformations, which are not around the corner, you're talking about, you're clearly rationing energy use, which means rationing lifestyle.
Yeah, you're impoverishing the first world countries, specifically the United States. In fact, here's what Barack Obama, the candidate in 2008, said. So if someone wants to build a coal power plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they will be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas being emitted. Under my plan of a cap-and-trade system, electricity will necessarily skyrocket.
Right, but this is an individual who comes from a movement who believes that corporations don't pay taxes, or that they pay taxes, people don't. When all of that gets passed through to us, I mean, how can you honestly believe that, well, shouldn't you just operate at a deficit for a few decades so that you can, make up for your the horrors you've caused on this planet? But he revealed a little understanding in there where he said, cause electricity prices to skyrocket. Well, who pays electricity?
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to clarify one thing from my perspective as a professor, there's all this talk about our carbon footprint, et cetera, again, with the assumption that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. And there are pollutants that come from the industrial processes, hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides that cause acid rain and particulate matter and ground-level ozone. These things are pollutants that are regulated. But carbon dioxide being thrown into the mix is just, or carbon monoxide certainly is a pollutant. But carbon dioxide is simply not a pollutant. And this is, I think, kind of how people are fooled into this, because they know there's something polluting about the industrial lifestyle, but they don't know the difference between one pollutant and another.
Right, and we, first of all, of course, this isn't about that. And I generally, the third question, because it's very easy to defeat the case for carbon rationing. It usually the second or third question is some student who says, well, some bearing to the following. But aren't there too many people? Shouldn't we drive smaller cars? Isn't it time we said we had enough? Shouldn't I recycle? And my answer is essentially everybody should recycle unless they don't want to. But if you're talking about chasing real pollutants, make your argument that I should drive a smaller car on its merits, or that you should have the state tell me what to drive on its merits, but not do what I want or everyone dies. But if you're talking about actual pollutants, because they say, are you saying there aren't pollutants in the world? Obviously you're scared of the presentation because you're avoiding it altogether. No. If you want to reduce sulfur dioxide, we have programs for that, but economists will tell you. And they're fairly uniform, so it also just makes sense. So let's listen to them. This is the least efficient, meaning most expensive way to reduce SO2 by chasing carbon dioxide. If you want to chase SO2 or mercury, chase SO2 or mercury. But as an excuse for cap and trade, it's just a revelation that their case for cap and trade is so weak that they would even bother with that, because it's a highly, highly inefficient, very expensive way to reduce actual pollution.
And that we learned with the SO2 experience, would you say that?
SO2 was in cap and trade, but it applied to an actual pollutant which you could scrub out or switch fuel fairly easily, thanks to rail deregulation, which was not anticipated. But it applied to 400 facilities throughout the country. It did result in blackouts in California. It did result in scarcity leading to shortages. It wasn't the success that some people are now saying it was in order to push it for CO2, but let's just say it was a success. It isn't CO2. It isn't economy-wide. It isn't a ubiquitous, benign, odorless, colorless gas that is produced in quantities that the Clean Air Act was never meant to arrest. And by the way, about which something we could never do anything. This is, I think the SO2 argument is, yes, we did do this. And yes, Europe learned from that, and from it they produced a disaster. And that's a very difficult case to make, that therefore it's a positive precedent, because Europe did take those lessons and improved upon them, and they produced a disaster.
In other words, the Kyoto Protocol type, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I'm afraid I am about out of voice and at least voice.
Well, we sure appreciate you joining us, Chris. I would just say that it's dawned on me recently that people like you and myself and others who are trying to inject reality, a complex reality, back into this debate, that we're fighting against a Machiavellian axiom, which is that a simple lie repeated over and over again is more appealing than a complicated truth. And I think in almost an hour and a half here, 2 hours, we've shown how complex this issue is. And I hope we can transmit some of that to enough people to make some positive change. It's much easier, I think, for the average person to believe, oh, it's getting too hot and it's our fault, therefore we'll accept change. So we're swimming against the current of Machiavellian techniques, I'm afraid, here.
But we also pointed out some of the very simple ways that it does distill. And if that's necessary, you know, look out the window. And it's not. The models are wrong. And there are people you should suspect behind this. And since Al Gore told us that where you receive your money dictates your position, where's that $300 million coming from? And until we get answers to these things, we're not moving forward.
Well, Chris, I want to really thank you for agreeing to come on our program, and appreciate all the your expertise in this matter, because I know in our area they've really picked up on this global warming issue, and it's nice to get the other side.
We're out here. We're out here, and there's an awful lot more of us than the media would have you believe. And in fact, if science were a democracy, I've showed them mine. Now they should show us theirs. Where is the overwhelming majority? No one's ever provided me anything other than referring to the 52 authors of the IPCC report. I'm sorry, you're vastly outnumbered.
Well, thanks so much, Chris. It was really great to talk to you, and thanks for your work. I
appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for spreading it. You know, it's nothing without folks out there who draw others' attention to it.
We're spreading it best we can. So keep up the good fight there.
Thank you. Take care.
And thank you.
Bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.